Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Yeah, I will start out by moving House File 3295 to re-refer to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill is a bill that relates to joint petitions. Under current law, couples that are divorcing, having been married, of course, have the ability to file a joint petition with the court. That encourages couples to work outside of the courtroom to come up with a consensus and then come and present it to the judge and basically have his blessing upon it. And under current law, the same privilege to have a joint petition does not exist for unmarried couples in custody cases. So that's what this bill does, is it creates that joint petition, hopefully reducing animosity between the two parents and helping them to come to consensus and then coming before the court and having the joint petition approved by the judge.
Thank you. Do you have any testifiers on this bill?
I have someone from the department that's here for technical assistance if people have questions, but other than that, that's really the only person.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted folks to know that this was non-controversial in civil law.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I haven't had time to go through every line of this, but so currently when it's a joint petition, when people are married, if there are kids involved, there's still a hearing. Would there still be a hearing when the judge would have both parties in front of the judge to approve of the agreement?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Thank you.
Any public testimony on this bill? Okay, with that, I will. Representative Scott, any final comment?
No, I just really appreciate your support. I think it'll help a lot of people.
Thank you. I myself think this is a good bill, so I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3295 to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up, we have House File 2987, Representative Keel. The chair will move House File 2987 to be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Keel, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate everybody hearing this bill. This is a drug repository bill and is really allowing people that don't use or don't have a need for drugs anymore, especially think nursing home, that type of thing, maybe they passed away or whatever, certain drugs that are able to be not thrown away but gone through a central repository and to a wholesale distributor and would be able to be given to somebody who maybe can't afford to purchase drugs or a way to use them that in a safe way. And with me today is Rowan Mann. That sorry about that, Rowan. We've been doing this long enough. I shouldn't have troubles. Anyway, she is finishing her pharmacy license and came to me with this bill and asked if we could consider it. And with that, I will ask her to explain House File 2987 in better detail.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record and please continue.
Hi, my name is Rowan Mann. I am a pharmacy student and a Master's of Public Health student at the university. And I am here today representing an international student group there. And we brought this bill to Representative Keel. And it looks at long-term care facilities. for the most part, and in long-term care facilities, they'll generally package patients' medications for 2 weeks or for a month. And that generally works really well, except for if a medication change happens or if the patient dies. Those medications then have to be thrown away under the current law. And that doesn't sound like it would be that big a deal, but in 2014, a study was conducted across the United States, and we found that $2 billion.
Excuse me, ma'am, can you put that right down? You have people behind you that cannot see.
I look forward, yes.
Thank you. Please continue.
So in 2014, there was a study that showed that we were wasting $2 billion across the United States in safe medications that we're having to throw away because of the packaging. In Colorado specifically, they did a study of their 220 long-term care facilities, and they were throwing away about $10 million worth of safe drugs every year. For comparison, we have 365 long-term care facilities. So we're throwing away safe medications, but at the same time, there are many patients who cannot receive their medications. There are studies that show anywhere between $100 to $290 billion worth of healthcare costs are because patients aren't taking their medications as prescribed because they can't afford them. I work at North Memorial Hospital as a pharmacy intern, so every shift I go in and I talk to patients about how they're taking their medications, and every shift I talk to at least one patient who is not taking their medications as prescribed, and that's why they're in the ER. So this legislation is looking to take those medications that are being thrown away currently and allowing them to go to patients who otherwise cannot afford them. This has been done and is operational in 20 other states. This language is heavily based off Iowa's language, which has been run since 2008. They've helped over 71,000 patients and have been able to donate out over $17.7 million worth of medications. Wyoming is another great example. They've been running since 2007. They've helped over 150,000 prescriptions that have been estimated to be about $12.5 million. I know that we're in the public health one, so subdivision 6 goes over all of the safety requirements. They can't be expired. They have to be in unopened, tamper-proof evidence packaging. All these medications will have to be reviewed by a pharmacist. The Board of Pharmacy actually helped rewrite this legislation. Dr. Weider did, and the Board of Pharmacy approves of this legislation. So, yes. Are there any questions?
Any questions from the committee? Any people in the audience from the public wish to testify on this bill? Representative Keel, any final comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I thank you very much for supporting this.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2987 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Motion approved. You're on your way to Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have House File 192, Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
This is my third time.
Chair, I move House File 192 to be re-referred to the General Register.
Mr. Chair.
And the House will also, or the Chair will also move the DE2 amendment. Representative Hester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the DE2 was a technical error that it didn't meet the 24-hour rule. It was actually in with the office. It just, the wrong amendment got posted. So at this point, I have no objection to us considering that amendment, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Representative Heitzman, please go ahead with your bill.
Thank you. So this is exactly the third time that this idea has been before this committee. And Representative Hillstrom, I thank you for understanding the issue with the amendment. This started for me a number of years ago when a constituent, Sue Vanek, came to me with the story of her daughter, Macy Vanek. So some of you might Remember, I brought testifiers in, Sue Vanek specifically, to talk about her situation, her frustration. On January 15th, 2015, Macy Kavanaugh, who was 24 at the time, was struck and severely injured by a driver who'd had his license suspended, I think, 12 or 13 times. And the frustration through that process, not only dealing with the severe injury to her daughter and granddaughter, but also then came once they wound up in the in court viewing proceedings, in the difficulty trying to get a charge greater than a misdemeanor was very significant. So that's really where this bill came forward, or how this bill came forward. It is an enhanced penalties bill. And the amendment is a result of a lot of work trying to figure out what the obstacles might be. Included today is a list of penalties specifically that trigger a third strike that would allow for a gross misdemeanor to be used in case of a charge. And then the second trigger would be in the case of great bodily harm. So those elements together basically are the summation of my bill. And I've asked Nonpartisan Research if they would like to just kind of go through just briefly some of the differences between the bill that was heard previous and the bill that's before us today, if members would like. Otherwise, we can move forward with questions.
Any questions from members on this bill? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hudson. So as I'm looking at this, I'm trying to grapple with all the things that are in this, because it's a pretty far encompassing bill. And I understand your desire to have repeat offenders and individuals that cause great bodily harm enhanced penalty that would hopefully make it so they don't do it again. As I look at the brief and as I read the bill, and I read the statement, it commits the violation for a third or subsequent time within 10 years. I think back to Representative Zerloss's bill for individuals that have had fines and had been driving without a license because it had gotten suspended and they didn't go to court, they didn't know that, and they start this downward spiral of fines. Can you speak to how this would impact those types of individuals that don't have any really new violation except maybe failure to use a turn signal or a taillight out or something of that nature? Because I don't think it's your intent to increase fines on all of them, but I think that that's what this bill might actually do.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, that specifically what I was referencing here in this list that should be in your packet. We don't want to go after those folks that have the proverbial turn signal or other issue that has potentially triggered a suspension of their license. And so these other driving-related issues are the list of concerns that we have relative to this issue. So, for example, reckless or careless driving violation, hitting a pedestrian with a motor vehicle, fleeing a peace officer, violation of DWI law. Those are things that would trigger the third strike, potentially, or an enhanced penalty. So we're trying to get at the heart of the issue and at the specific individuals that are breaking the law in a way that we feel fits with bad driving, not so much maybe a missed child support payment.
Sure. Mr. Chair? When I look at the list, all of these make sense to me and are pretty clear, but when I read the habitual violator of the traffic laws, and he has Statute 171.18, Subdivision 1, Clause 4. I have no idea what that is. Is this someone driving under a suspended license? Because what that does, this particular thing, if that's what it is, what it does then is it does sort of go contrary to Representative Zerloss's previous bill. And I just don't have the statute in front of me.
Representative Zuar.
Mr. Chair, members representing. It's my understanding, reviewing the DE amendment in comparison with the DE amendment that was offered on this bill in the other body, and looking at this list of priors for enhanced penalties, I think this DE amendment gets to exactly what some concerns were about enhancing penalties on instances with suspended driver's license due to unpaid fines and stuff. So I think this language goes a long way to address those concerns. I'm very comfortable with the language in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zulas. I'd still like to know what, you know, Statute 171.18 Subdivision 1 Clause 4 actually is, because if we're going to pass something that includes that, I think it would be good for us to know what that particular statute actually is referring to.
We'll see if Mr. Johnson can, from House Research, can answer your question.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, Representative Dean, the statute simply says 171.18 Subdivision 1 Paragraph A Clause 4 is an habitual violator of the traffic laws. I'm looking to see if that is defined anywhere else in the statute, and I'm not finding it at the moment.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Heisman, that concerns me, because if someone had gotten a couple driving while under suspension, and then additionally because they couldn't get insurance, driving without insurance, that would be three strikes, and that would be habitual. And that concerns me. I mean, I understand all the other things you have in here. They make complete sense. But I'm just a little bit concerned about that particular statute that's referenced. And I'm not sure how I'll vote, but I'll give it some thought.
Any other?
Well, Mr. Chair, one other thing. I mean, is that something you'd be willing to consider taking out? Or more clearly defining prior to it actually getting to the floor and offering an amendment? Because if you don't, I probably will.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, no. At this point, the language, I think, is very well set between the Senate body, and we're prepared to defend the language going forward.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Then I just feel bad for you, Representative Zulas, because we're doing something in contradiction to the bill that you recently passed.
Representative Zulas?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Dean, it's my understanding that this language was crafted specifically to avoid those types of instances. My understanding is the habitual offender language is exactly what is the backstop in the bill that we voted for last week, that talked about if you continue to engage in driving conduct that will result in multiple convictions in a period of time, that habitual offender piece will kick in and cause a suspension. So not your unpaid tickets, but the driving conduct leading up to that. So in consultation with advocates involved in those bills that we voted for last week on this language, they're very comfortable with this language, and it's one of the reasons I'll be supporting Representative Heitzman's bill today.
Thank you. I believe
Mr. Chair,
I believe Mr. Johnson has a little.
We can also talk offline.
Mr. Chair and members, I can provide a little more information on the habitual violators definition. It appears in administrative rules. And what it says is that a person has a license suspended for being a habitual violator if that person has, and there's a list here, but 4 traffic offenses within a 12-month period, 5 within a 24-month period, and then it also is a longer suspension if it's 5 within a 12-month period or 6 within a 24-month period, and an even longer suspension if there are 7 within a 24-month period. And that's violations of either Chapter 169 or Chapter 171, which are essentially the driving conduct rules and the driver's license rules.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Is there anybody from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Heiston, any last comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very thankful to have the opportunity to present this bill once again and look forward to having it out on the floor.
Thank you for coming here. The chair then will renew his motion to re-refer House File 192 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. The motion passed. Representative Heisman, good luck, and we'll see. Talk to you at another time. Next, House File 1481. Members, Representative Grossley moves to re-refer House File 1481 to the General Register. Representative Grossley, welcome to the hot seat, and you may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 1481 was the bill that I presented last session, and it received support to me from both sides, and respectfully so, because it is a bill to bring more protection to our emergency personnel and our hospital personnel. It is to make sure that they have some recourse in case they have been assaulted and or injured in the line of their duties. So with that being said, Mr. Chair, I have a few testifiers that would like to come up and speak in support.
Okay, before we get to that, I do believe you have the amendment, the A1 amendment. Do you wish to move that forward at this time?
At this time, Mr. Chair, one of the stakeholders, Nani, had some language that they would like to see added to the bill. I would like to speak more with them about that. I know the amendment was late in coming, and I would like to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music as far as the language.
Okay. I was talking about the A1, which changes.
Oh, I'm sorry. The date change. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The other one will come later. Sorry. Yes, I'd like to move to amend that.
Okay. Any questions from the committee on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is approved.
Got ahead of myself a little bit.
Is there any questions? Or let's go to the testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. We're an association that represents about 1,700 firefighters, paramedics, and dispatchers located all over the state of Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 1481. And I would like to point out that you won't find too many folks in my profession that have been around for any number of years that don't have a story to tell of some kind of physical assault or altercation. Many of the scenes that we go into are often chaotic. We have very little information from dispatch oftentimes before we arrive on the scene. And every once in a while, we do get ourselves into a situation where things do escalate. There was a study put out by the National Institutes of Health in 2013. It was a study of almost 2,000 EMS workers, and 43% of them stated that within the previous 12 months that they had been the victim of physical violence. There are, I know that there are mental health advocates that do have some concerns about the bill. I just want to make 2 points. That the bill does not take away law enforcement's or prosecutor's rights to look at the evidence in a case of physical violence against a firefighter or a medical personnel and to charge or not charge that accordingly. And often it's not the patient that's the issue. Often bystanders do become an issue and insert themselves in the situation, especially when there's alcohol involved. And as a captain myself on the St. Paul Fire Department, I know that whenever I see in the dispatch notes that there's alcohol involved, I start the police right away, because oftentimes those situations do escalate. So thank you for your time, and I'd like to thank Representative Brunson for his bill. And I did bring with me a colleague of mine from the St. Paul Fire Department, Captain Art Baumeister. Thank you.
Captain, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name's Captain Art Baumeister. As Chris was talking about, I'm actually a victim of an assault. As he also said, a lot of things happen that probably don't even make it to the threshold or get charged out or reported. But in November of 2005, I was called to a difficulty breathing. And as I turned to set my bag down, I had a guy laying on his stomach. Came up, all of a sudden he was, when I turned back around, on top of me, and he landed a perfect right and knocked me right out. And I don't know all the, you know, what eventually happened, but it ended up, the charges were dropped. I think by elevating this to a more serious penalty, maybe it will make some of our colleagues in the legal community take it a little bit more seriously. And I'm not saying that they don't, but just kind of looking at the wording of the bill. I also work in a hospital setting. And all I can tell you is these caregivers they're in a very vulnerable state when they're taking care of people. And I'll add to the fact that oftentimes bystanders or family members can make things a little bit stressful, and they might be the ones who actually attack our crew or the person. So I'm in full support of this.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Anybody from the public wish to testify on this bill? Mr. Chair, I have a couple more.
Okay.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary C. Turner. I'm a registered nurse in the intensive care unit at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale. I'm also proud to be representing 22,000 registered nurses as the elected president of Minnesota Nurses Association. Violence against healthcare workers happens every day throughout the entire state of Minnesota. Incidences can be seemingly innocuous, as spitting, biting, or kicking, to the more serious acts of slapping, punching, and even urinating on caregivers. Sometimes a patient will grab anything within reach, such as a crutch or a walker, to use as a weapon against their healthcare worker. But I'd like to illustrate just exactly who this bill, or what kind of a person that this bill is meant for. I've asked many, like ED nurses, etc., that have said, we're not after the autistic young person who comes into an ED and is striking out because they're afraid. The type of person that we are is a young person, or a person who came into the intensive care that I work on. He had been strung out on something, had been intubated and then detoxed, etc. And so he was extubated, waiting to go out onto the floor. And he saw fit to corner a young 23-year-old, 120-pound nurse in the corner of his room. But more importantly, he kicked a 7-month-along pregnant nurse in the stomach. When asked the next day by the charge nurse if he realized what he had done, and explained to him what he had done the day before, He turns to the charge nurse. He goes, I sure did, and I'd do it again in a heartbeat. That's who this law is meant for. Somebody who knowingly strikes out against the very people who are trying to save their life. Usually a nurse suffers minor pain, but often nurses suffer bruises, bleeding, broken noses, broken bones, knocked out teeth, or even more severe debilitating injury that costs a healthcare worker time on the job or even a career. And I'm sorry, guys, but as a representative of healthcare workers all over the state, hearing these kind of things is like a knife in my heart. Yet until that very graphic incident at St. John's Hospital in Maplewood back in 2014, it was easy to dismiss these acts as a normal part of a job. And just one little incident about that, I once had a nurse in a nurse meeting. And she walked in and I said, sir, I go, so how was your day? She goes, in a matter of fact voice, well, I didn't get hit. I said, as I'm like swallowing a bile in my throat, I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, that's how I gauge my day, and whether I have a good day or a bad day, on whether I get hit. Yet too often, when a healthcare worker or first responder is assaulted, they are told that there's no point in pursuing the case against the offender because it didn't happen in the emergency room. Under present law, as you know, an assault is only a felony if it happens in the emergency room. But those of us on the street and at the bedside know assault happens everywhere. It also happens in the new mental health units that are being built off of all the emergency rooms. Let me be clear. Nurses aren't looking to punish patients or their families. We understand that they're in difficult situations, often a case of life or death. They're scared, they're confused, and they're often medicated. We know this. We know this as nurses and other healthcare workers. We hope that the real effect of this bill is to act as a deterrent against violence against caregivers, no matter what kind of badge they wear. Nurses of the Minnesota Nurses Association feel strongly that violence is not a part of the job. It's not just part of our job description. We hope this effort by Representative Matt Grassl will create a safe environment for patients to heal and effectively address the rare incidences when an aggressive person should be charged with assault. We trust Representative Grassl knows what it's like. He told me as a police officer that he's had experiences where he brings a patient in handcuffs into a rural hospital, takes off the handcuffs, and then leaves that person for these young nurses to handle. He saw fit to see this as an issue, and we thank him for bringing this issue to the forefront and doing something about it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abt Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. First, I want to say that we don't ever want a healthcare worker to be injured or a first responder. We rely on them greatly to take care of people. And I want to say that I have done direct care in the psychiatric facility. Excuse me, in a program for people with multiple disabilities. You know, I've been hit. I've experienced all of that. What we're really concerned about is that this bill expands it beyond the emergency room, which could include a psychiatric unit. And so you have someone who is especially in a community hospital in severe psychotic state, they really may not know what they're doing, and we don't want them to be charged with a felony. And it is a big deal to have a felony versus a misdemeanor. We have had situations where we've had to fight as advocates where someone was very, very ill, really did not, you know, have the capacity to understand what they were doing. You know, having it be a felony versus a misdemeanor would not be a deterrent because of their mental state at the time. I really appreciate the fact that Representative Bethel and I have been communicating the last 2 days to try to figure out if we can, at least if someone has diminished capacity due to a mental illness or a mental impairment, and it could be, you know, Alzheimer's, it, you know, could be a number of different things, that it wouldn't be a felony, it would be a misdemeanor. You know, when you get a felony, you lose your housing, ability to access housing. If you go to jail,
jail. It's very difficult for people to get their medications. I think we don't want to kind of go down that path, and I know that Representative Gosel doesn't want to either. So I just wanted to make sure that the committee heard my concerns. We're going to keep working, but just wanted to raise that, bring that to your attention.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Representative Gosel, for bringing this forward. I also share NAMI's concerns coming from that field as well. And I know you and I had talked about possibly doing an amendment, and you had some concerns about the physical limitations. In other words, if someone did have dementia or if they had a brain injury, so a traumatic brain injury also can manifest that way. But we certainly don't want to include folks that are in a disassociative state and they aren't in their right mind. And so it's... And I just wanted to reemphasize that and also realize that this would exacerbate issues for those with SPMI. They would, as NAMI has stated, that they might lose their housing, they might lose a stable job. It's a big difference from a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, to the felony level. So I just hope that you continue to work with them so we don't make the situation worse for these folks and actually cause them to end up in the ER more because their life is so... in a disarray because of it. So I just ask you to continue to work with them and make sure that we carve those folks out as opposed to those, as the nurse described when she was here, that they knew full well what they were doing and that was their intent. And we want to push that out, please.
Representative Pinball.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grossel, and to all the testifiers, including Ms. Abderhoven. Any assault on somebody in one of the helping professions is reprehensible, and so thank you for bringing this forward. I'm trying to understand a little bit the expansion to any medical worker in a hospital, I guess, versus so why a hospital versus other medical facilities? I do have a concern. We have a series of bills, of course, where we're concerned about particular professions and wanting to protect them. And is there a reason we would stop at this point versus stop at another as we're trying to have that protection?
Representative Gosel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. The reason I stopped at the hospital is because in my own experience with many other peace officers, with firefighters, paramedics, etc., when you bring something from the street, it's going to the ER, and then if it hasn't settled down by then, they progress into the hospital itself, and the attacks that were described happened in the hospital setting and not in the ER setting. Okay. So, I know nobody wants to see anyone injured. I know that I don't want to see people who are not in a state of control in their mind to be charged with something that they have no idea, or they have, and they will continue to have no idea what they have done. And that is the feelings of MMNA, the firefighters, paramedics, right on down the line. Okay. And that's where, you know, in discussion with Representative O'Neill and with NAMI, I have confidence that the stop gaps that we have already would be proficient to weed that, to make sure that doesn't happen. But, again, if we can tighten it up more, I'm willing to have those conversations. These people are putting their lives out there. They're putting they're put into vulnerable positions under some of the worst conditions. Mm-hmm. They're there to help people, and to give them a little more protection, I believe that there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and I know you agree with that. Okay. So, but that is why I stopped there.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the members? Anybody from the public wish to testify on this bill? Hey, Representative Grossel, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's something that needs to be looked at. But I do believe the Rule 20 would take care of a lot. Is a good backstop to take care of some of the concerns that a couple of the groups have. Any last comments?
Not really, Mr. Chair. I guess in answering Representative Pinto's question, I got those last comments out there of the importance of this bill to to bring more protection for our emergency personnel, our hospital personnel, and to make sure that if they are attacked, if they are injured, that they have something to fall back on. It's after the fact. All of it is after the fact. But to have something that will hopefully deter someone from attacking them.
Thank you. With that, Representative Grassl renews his motion to re-refer House File 1481 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Kitty.
Next, we have House File 4023. Representative Howard moved the latest House bill, House File 4023, the layover for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'd like to do is start out by offering a technical amendment on lines 2.14 to change 0.014 to 0.14, and on line 2.18 from 0.005 to 0.05.
Representative Hillstrom, do you have any problems with that?
No objection.
Thank you. Any members have any questions on that technical amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Technical amendment is approved. Representative Howell, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, House File 4023 is an attempt to try to bring into scope some of the things that we did last year when we passed the bill to have those places of assembly over 200 to be reviewed by the state building official. We passed that last year. What we identified, though, was many of these places of assembly that are outside jurisdictions that enforce the code, that are supposed to notify the state building official when they remodel a place or when they're going to build a place like this. We found that because they're in a place that does not normally enforce the building code, many of them don't even know that they need to get a permit. During that time, so they remodel or they open up their shingle, they have this place of assembly. Now it's constructed, and we found that when we notify the state building official that this place has been built, well, now what it falls into is it's an existing non-conforming structure. So the building code doesn't really apply. So in order to get these things looked at, we look to the state fire marshal's office because those are the folks that actually deal with most of the existing buildings. So what I did was I took what we do for schools, public schools, and modified it slightly and tried to apply it to places of assembly. I'll tell you that I went to a wedding in one of these wedding barns, and that's what this is really trying to get to. I went to one just south of Hinckley last year, built specifically for weddings, brand new structure. I walked in there, I looked around, and I told my wife we're sitting right by the door. And she said, "Why is that?" Because I said, if something happens in here, not everybody's getting out. But I'm going to make sure I get out. This was a brand new barn, all rough sawn wood, beautiful structure, but there was no fire alarm, there was no exit signs, there was no panic hardware. That's why, after 27 years in the fire service, and now as a building official, I plopped my hind end right next to the door and made sure that at least me and my wife were going to get out of there if something did happen. So what I have here now is testify. So what this bill would do is it allow the state fire marshal's office to go out and inspect these once every 3 years, much like we do schools, hotels, those types of occupancies. Because I, in response to something like the Thumper Pond incident where we had a building collapse out there by Fergus Falls, I believe that it's in the public's best interest. And with that, I'll turn to my testifier, someone that built the wedding barn, did everything right, and his concerns with some of these other venues.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and then proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Randy Schmitz. I own a venue called Rolling Ridge Wedding and Event Center in St. Joseph, Minnesota, right next to St. Cloud. Our small family business has employees. We hire several other supporting businesses such as caterers, photographers, etc. I'm here today to show my support for this legislation providing funding to inspect existing places of public accommodation for fire code compliance. With the revenue to support these inspections provided by the fees collected by these businesses from the inspections. We've hosted hundreds of events at our facility. I understand the event industry pretty well. I'm a licensed building contractor, and I was the general contractor responsible for getting our certificate of occupancy for our buildings for place of public accommodation. It took me almost 3 years, though, to get through the planning to develop a plan that met all the codes that we were required to follow. We are within the city limits. I had to prove to the bank that it could be a financially sound business, and I also had to make sure as a part of that that I could properly insure my buildings for the intended use. Before our first guests could even enter or step foot in our facility, we needed to make sure, at a minimum, our buildings complied with 7 different code areas. The first, the state building code. We had to get engineered certified plans. All of our structures on the property had to be done. This ensured that buildings that were originally designed for static loads, like hay, could be properly suited to handle live loads, like people dancing, along with the snow and wind loads. State mechanical fuel and gas code, we had to install 8 oversized furnaces to provide the proper ventilation. Plumbing code, we had to have 12 toilets, 8 sinks. The state accessibility code, actually, so everybody could get in and out of our building in case of an emergency. We ended up having to hire a company to lift our entire barn off of its original structure and put it on a new footing that was accessible. State energy code required us to insulate and climate control our buildings, even though we were a seasonal business. The National Electric Code required a new 800 amp service of electrical. And we even had to go so far as covering our barn every night with plastic to ensure that any of the exposed wires wouldn't get wet because it was a restoration. And then lastly, the Minnesota State Fire Code required us to install a fire suppression system, fire alarms, lighted exits, additional exit doors, special footings by the doors with breakaway bars because the sliding barn doors weren't a suitable exit. We had to put fire dampers in, fire-rated doors, and firewalls in several locations on our property. We questioned every code requirement. We realized that the codes were practical, but they were extremely expensive to implement. Before we moved forward, we discussed the code with our local and state officials, and they assured us that these codes are mandatory and that every venue would be required to follow these rules. We've operated this business for 3 years now, and we know of more than 100 new venues that have popped up since we've started. I know many of these venues do not even come close to following the code. We're aware of these venues because couples who book our venue usually tell us where they end up booking their wedding. And anyone who's been to a wedding knows there's people, food, beverages, inflammable decorations, and lots of photos. A simple visit to these businesses, Facebook pages, or websites, and it's pretty clear that most of these items are missing from their buildings. I have personal images from these buildings because I visited several of them, and it's pretty scary. Barns where you can actually see through the roof, where the floor moves up and down several inches during the dance. I even met with one venue owner who bans the DJ from playing certain songs because the barn floor shifts to the point of electrical conduits breaking in the basement below it. So here's what's going on. Many of these existing properties came into existence because they had a barn. They painted it, mowed the grass, and held a wedding for a family member. At this wedding, several people asked them if they could have their wedding there for a friend or a family member. They soon found out the revenue potential and instantly their business. without a permit or going through the proper engineering processes. Others have simply built a shed or a barn on their personal property with a permit, but listed it for a use as a storage building or an agricultural building or simply like a workshop. Soon after the inspection, the building became a business and it's used for an event business. If I lied and didn't follow the code, I knew my business could potentially be shut down, I could be sued, end up in jail. Aside from this risk, my investment would have only been a couple $1,000. We followed the code and it cost us well over $1 million. I lie awake at night worrying about these 100 other venues that have come into existence almost overnight, that have done little more than lay down a layer of plywood on the holes in their floor. I worry about all their friends, grandparents, co-workers who are invited and pressured to attend these weddings at establishments just assuming that these buildings are safe because it's a business. So what if one of these structures collapses or starts on fire when it's potentially full of intoxicated wedding guests? Dry wooden floor structures, decorations just waiting to implode or burst into flames. I lose sleep. The potential risk these buildings are placing their guests in, knowing that when these barns start on fire without proper life safety equipment, such as fire sprinklers, the barn will burn and people will die. And our industry will turn to ashes, and my investment will be sitting vacant. No commerce, no first dances, no memories, no jobs for catering teams, no beverage or income taxes collected. I support this bill, and I encourage your support because this bill has the potential to save hundreds of lives. This issue has grown out of control quickly, and this important life safety measure could ensure at least one of the already required life safety codes are properly enforced. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Howe. I'm just going to ask a question just because I think it needs to be asked. If a site happens to be within like 25 miles of a border of other states where other states have not this type of stringent requirements within the building codes, is that something we can expect to see something maybe a year or two from now that might actually reverse some of this for some of those border cities?
Representative Powell?
Members, Representative Dean, not from me.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair, representatives of the committee. Thank you. My name is Wayne Butt. And along with my wife, Angie Butt, we own the historic John P. Ferber Farm in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. I am a disabled veteran, so it is a disabled veteran-owned business. And I, like Randy in front of me, have a very large investment to include an SBA loan. And I think the SBA and Merchants Bank would be highly upset with Angie and myself if this continues down the path that it's going. I speak only of barns, as this is what I've learned over the last 4 years. Other venues such as country club, golf courses, churches, halls, etc. are at equal risk, as I have seen them in person. Have you ever been to a barn dance or a wedding? For some reason, couples touring are not looking for fire suppression systems and safety features. They are looking for the ambiance of the property and its features. This tells us safety is not a concern unless the parents are touring and we educate them. The problem is now all these beautiful properties are wedding venues with no safety in mind for the couples. Therefore, we in this room need to fix a very large problem. I too, like Randy Schmitz, have sleepless nights. Mine are similar in that the industry is going so fast we haven't had a chance to grasp what damage this will cause long term. We purchased a beautiful rundown property 8 years ago with the thought of having weddings on the property grounds. That was the dream, but the reality set in quickly when the city of Cottage Grove threw the rule book at us. We were crushed because it would cost us over $1 million to save this property the right way. The market is hot for barn weddings, and we quickly realized in 2017 the folks that own Barnes in Minnesota and Wisconsin are putting family and friends in a tinderbox without one safety feature, let alone ADA accessibility. We are waiting for the inevitable to happen, the trend for beautiful properties transformed overnight with lipstick and lawn service. And this has created a monster. This monster is beating on the door like the Grim Reaper and waiting for the call of duty. Folks will die like in the February 20th, 2003 station nightclub fire that took over 100 innocent lives and injured over 200 because the owners did not follow building codes. Please look at youtube.com and search nightclub fire along with barn fires. The snap, crackle, pop is the most eerie feeling. A fire in an old 50 to 100 year old barn or building is a tragedy waiting to happen here in Minnesota. Think of the silage dust, cobwebs, kindling waiting for a spark as alcohol is consumed and cigarettes are smoked. We have a chance to make a difference being proactive versus reactive. I rode my motorcycle over the I-35W bridge July 31st, 2007, the day before the collapse on August 1, killing 13 innocent people. The reaction was to inspect bridges across America. We too asked that we inspect all barns and venues holding events. There is no magical number over 100 as small venues exceed capacity on weekends when the government is not working. The loss of one life is too many as it cannot be avoided because it can be avoided with safety. The evidence is in front of us that a venue will burn down and has burned down due to accidental ignition, match, candles, cigarettes, or an electrical fire. A barn dance venue in Arthur, North Dakota was taken down due to an electrical fire October 2017. It too had no fire suppression and unfortunately burned down on a day that there were fortunately no one present. It was closed on a Thursday. Rural properties do not have city water mains with endless supply of water. The fire department can only deliver about 2,000 gallons of water per truck. But wait, the response time to rural areas is 5 to 10 minutes and it only takes 5 to 10 minutes for a barn to burn down. Once a barn starts on fire, there's no putting it out. We call this a controlled burn because we cannot find one barn in America that was saved by a fire department. Now think of the contamination chemicals stored over the years and now flowing to the nearest stream pond for consumption by humans and nature. 3M is paying for it now in South Washington County, where our barn is. The clock is ticking. Please do all you can to protect the lives of innocent family and members attending a wedding or celebration. Be proactive in making it equally difficult statewide to open a venue following the building fire codes to a T. It is the law and it needs to be enforced. Thank you very much.
Members, I will say that I need to continue to work on this bill. I don't think it's narrow enough. Right now I think it kind of we tried to narrow this bill by saying that we exempted service club organizations like VFWs and Legions, we exempted churches, we exempted places that don't have alcohol on the premises, because we figure if you've got your faculties in place and you're not drinking alcohol, you probably can get out. We're trying to narrow this down to where we think it will cause an issue, but I'm working with the hospitality industry to try and find the definitions to try and narrow this down even further so we can get to just the venues that we're talking about. So we're going to continue to work on that piece.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Howe, for pushing this and for working forward. I guess I'm struck in hearing these stories about these tragedies and the steps being taken to prevent them. When thinking too about the bill, previous bill we've heard about assaults, etc. I'm mindful, and I did not know that we would have some folks in the audience today who are themselves, I think, standing or sitting in witness of tragedies. And so I appreciate you moving forward on this, and I feel like this is an appropriate just moment to acknowledge the need to take steps to prevent tragedies. And I hope that you can move forward on this bill. I hope that we can move forward on actions to prevent senseless deaths that we're experiencing in so many ways. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and many thanks to those who are here in silent witness to this. Thank you.
Any other public testimony? Hey, Representative Holland, I thank you for bringing this bill forward. But before I refer this, I do have a comment for Mr. Butts. So you do have something. I want to give a shout out to a fire department in my district that put the fire out in more than one barn in my district without the barn burning down. We have very good fire departments across the state, and they do stop barn fires.
Okay.
And with that, I will move to lay over House File 4023 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is House File 4044, Representative Considine. Representative Considine, before you start, I'm going to remind this young lady, if the sign goes above her head again, she will be removed. Representative Considine, do you wish to move your bill?
I do.
Move my bill. General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says on here that it expands. Actually, I look at this as more of being housekeeping. At the beginning, in line 1.17, it refers to the transfer of bodily fluids, but in line 2.2, it says the transfer of urine, semen, and blood. And I'd just like to have that changed to bodily fluids. As in Representative Grossler's bill just a minute ago, they refer to bodily fluids. I believe that the reason that that was changed at the time was that people were thinking strictly of AIDS, which cannot be transferred by being saliva. However, I would point out to the committee that tuberculosis can, influenza can, both of which in the 20th century killed far more people than AIDS. And that's simply what the bill does, is switch to bodily fluids. I was asked if I wanted testifiers. I didn't really think that was necessary. Again, I look at it as being simply a housekeeping thing. To switch it to bodily fluids.
Okay. And before you go any further, since I've given you the opportunity, but I will move to re-refer House File 4044 to the General Register. Now we can continue.
Well, I think I've pretty much finished what I had to say, unless somebody has some questions.
Any questions from the members? Okay. Any public testimony? And with that, I will renews his motion for House File 4044 to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You're on your way to the General Register. And
thank
with
you.
That, members, we will adjourn.
An action process. Shame on murderers. Shame you on have you. Your seat. Shame on you. Vote them out.